Moscow displaying the no-entry sign to almost 1,000 prominent Americans, including President Biden, reciprocating similar moves by Washington. Israeli's incoming prime minister pledges fresh relations with the world following elections that ended conservative rule after almost a decade. And public transport partially reopens in Shanghai, China's largest city's moving to ease COVID restrictions. This is World News, a live broadcast from our Tehran studios. I'm Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The top story this hour, Russia blacklisting some 960 U.S. citizens in response to Western sanctions. Leading Americans on the foreign ministry's list include President Joe Biden, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Hollywood actor Morgan Freeman. The individuals are banned from entry to Russia indefinitely. The foreign ministry says that the sanctions are necessary to counter the U.S. attempts to establish, quote, a neo-colonial world order on the rest of the planet. Moscow has already blacklisted the State Secretary Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin. Russia, however, says it remains open to honest dialogue and that it draws a line between the American people and authorities, inciting Russophobia. The Ukrainian president believes that there is only one way to resolve the conflict with Russia. That's diplomacy. Volodymyr Zelensky says that Ukraine did not start the conflict, but it has to finish it. According to the official, even though Ukraine can be victorious on the battlefield, a breakthrough will only be reached at the negotiating table. Meantime, an aide to Zelensky says that there is no way Ukraine would agree to a ceasefire or accept any deal with Moscow that involves surrendering territory. Mykhailo Podolyak, who is also Ukraine's lead negotiator, says that making concessions would backfire, and that's because Russia would hit back harder after any break in fighting. Currently, negotiations are deadlocked, with both sides accusing each other of stalling the process. Now, in other news, Italy has increased its imports of Russian crude despite efforts by the European Union to reduce dependency on Russian energy. Moscow has exported around 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy this month. That's more than four times as much as in February, and the highest since 2013. Two-thirds of those exports are destined for a port in Sicily, where a Russian-controlled refinery is located. Lenders have stopped financing that refinery after the EU imposed sanctions on Moscow over Ukraine. This forced the refinery, that's owned by Moscow-based corporation Lukoil, to rely solely on supplies from its parent company. The growing crude shipments to Russian-owned refineries in the EU come as the bloc is working on ways to wean itself off Russian fossil fuels. The situation is escalating between Russia and the West as Moscow is pledging a proper response to a bid by Sweden and Finland to join NATO. Hashtag trending reviews some of the related developments posted on social media.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, your host Ali Reza. The West's confrontation with Russia is escalating as the two Nordic states of Finland and Sweden announce their desire to join the NATO military alliance. Stay with us to see some reactions to the story through the lens of social media. The bid by Finland and Sweden to join NATO has prompted Moscow's immediate response. Russia's defense minister says that his country will take adequate countermeasures against threats to its western borders, and that includes the addition of 12 new units in its western military district. The rising tension between Russia and the West has sparked a wave of concern among social media users. People are afraid that these dangerous developments may lead to a third world war, which would include nuclear confrontation. And now let's read some comments. The first one comes from Eggplant Shill. Sweden and Finland joining NATO is a massive escalation that threatens a blockade of Russia's access to the Atlantic. It does not matter if NATO calls itself a mutual defense organization. You do not back a nuclear power into a corner. Manuja, I think is how you pronounce it, said Finland and Sweden applied for NATO membership. Finland shares a 1,340-kilometer border with Russia. It won independence from Moscow in 1917. If accepted, their presence would instantly more than double the border between NATO countries and Russia from around 750 miles to around 1,600. Chuchi Face said Russia is to expand its military presence near its western borders as a retaliation against Sweden and Finland's application to join NATO. And over here we have a comment by Green Flame the Fourth. The U.S. that is afraid to engage Russia in a direct conflict militarily is offering to protect Finland and Sweden when they join NATO. What a joke. What the U.S. is cleverly doing with NATO is principally to ensure that all future wars are fought in Europe without being taken to U.S. soil. Meanwhile, Turkey has raised objections to the two Nordic countries' bid to join NATO, blocking the organization from proceeding with the accession process. Turkish officials have also accused both Finland and Sweden of supporting and harboring anti-Ankara terrorists. Our next batch of comments starts with one by the Third Rail with Omar. Finland and Sweden have been harboring the PKK, a group designated as a terrorist organization by Turkey, the United States, and the European Union. Now that they got the jitters from Russia and want to join NATO, everyone is upset at Turkey for raising concerns. Izhar Chaudhary said Turkey's opposition regarding Finland's and Sweden's accession to NATO is, in principle, correct. This move by the two countries is only to please the U.S., which will only escalate rather than end the war in the region. Linda Brown said it is absolutely staggering that Turkey, which has the second largest military in NATO next to the U.S., was never consulted about whether Sweden and Finland should join the military alliance. Of course, the people of Sweden and Turkey were never consulted either. Now, here we have a tweet by Bosonaugras Mabulamashin. He said, the biggest features of Sweden and Finland for NATO are that they are outposts of England and Germany. If Turkey can prolong the process when there is a danger of war, America must support it. I think the real subject of the bargain should be American strategies in Central Asia. Many believe that NATO's eastward expansion is the root cause of the problem as Russia sees its security at stake. They accuse the U.S. of trying to maintain its hegemony over Europe by bringing the war to European soil. The final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Mr. Brain and Backbone. The superpower in NATO is the USA. When the USA wants something, it forces it by using genuine reasons or by fabricating one. Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq with support of NATO. This is bullying. The fear of Russia that Finland and Sweden have is the same fear that some non-NATO countries have of the USA. Indiana Jones said the Russia-Ukraine war was planned well in advance by the dark elite, hashtag Davos, that pulls the strings of many Western leaders. That's the reason behind NATO's provocative expansion plus arming of Ukraine. The shady elite behind U.S. and allies sees Russia plus China as a threat. Ukraine is just a pawn. A.S. Francis has a tweet that reads, the expansion of NATO is a blatant provocation which may trigger another war by Russia with the former republics of the Soviet Union. The expansion of NATO will pave the way for Russia to restore the Soviet Union for security reasons. And our final comment comes from Paolo Pancho Ribeiro. The reason countries lobby to join NATO is not because of what the U.S. wants, but because they fear Russian imperial expansion, and this aligns with U.S. desire to contain Russia and maintain U.S. hegemony over Europe. And with that, we have come to the end of another edition of Hashtag Trending. Till next time, take care and bye-bye.
Okay, now moving on, Australia making a transition from a conservative rule to a Labor government, with the incoming Prime Minister pledging fresh relations with the world and a transform of climate policies. Anthony Albanese says that he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. The Labor leader has called his upcoming summit with the Japanese, Indian, U.S. leaders an absolute priority. Climate is expected to be at the heart of those talks. Albanese and his government are expected to be sworn in Monday after Labor winning a parliamentary majority in general elections. He may still need a coalition partner to rule, but he has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The Labor victory ends nearly a decade of conservative rule in Australia, which is now associated with climate disasters such as burning forests and smog-enveloped cities. China's largest city of Shanghai is gradually emerging from a COVID lockdown in the wake of a slowing infections. Four of the city's 20 subway lines will now restart, along with some road transport, and this will form a basic network covering all central urban areas. Those who take public transport will have to show a negative COVID test within 48 hours and have a normal temperature. Some factories have also resumed operations, and residents in lower-risk areas are being allowed to venture outdoors. The city of 25 million residents reported more than 600 COVID cases on Sunday, almost all of them asymptomatic. Shanghai entered a strict lockdown at the end of March to combat a rising number of Omicron cases, in line with the country's zero COVID policy. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for a 17-year-old killed by Israeli forces. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes. The victim, identified as Amjad Al-Fayed, was shot dead during a raid on a Jenin refugee camp. Another teenager was also critically wounded. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shatai has condemned Fayed's killing, stressing that the international community should hold Israel accountable for its acts. The incident happened days after the Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akla while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied territories. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says that most victims of the Israeli attacks in the occupied West Bank in recent months have been teenagers.
Since the beginning of this year, 20 Palestinians were killed only in Jenin. Some four of them are under the age of 18. This Palestinian who was shot dead this morning, Amjad Al-Fayed, he's only 17 years old, and even less than this. His friend, 18 years old, was seriously wounded during this Israeli military operation to Jenin. We can say that many of the Palestinian youths and Palestinian young men continue to be engaged in the different forms of resistance. And maybe in the last few months, we are witnessing more Palestinians are holding arms, trying to prevent the fully armed Israeli soldiers with their armored vehicles and tanks from raiding Jenin refugee camp. According to witnesses and according to Palestinian paramedics in the Jenin refugee camp, Amjad Fayed was shot by almost a dozen rounds in his upper part.
Okay, now we got a couple of reports from the UK. The first one, the British Home Secretary Priti Patel has branded the anti-Israel boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. Now, that comment was made during a recent speech at a pro-Israel lobby group meeting where she additionally reaffirmed her loyalty in defending Israel. Robert Carter has a report.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper, structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
A new list released by British daily The Sunday Times says that there are a record number of billionaires in the UK, with the richest 250 people worth more than £500 billion. Released in the middle of a soaring cost of living crisis, this year's list has new entrants, among them a UK government minister and his wife.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily The Sunday Times' rich list. In this country, it says, 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over. Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife. The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty. First published in 1989, the Sunday Times rich list bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super-rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Pour is up, London.
Heavy rains have caused widespread flooding in parts of Bangladesh and India, leaving millions stranded and nearly 60 people dead. In Bangladesh, some 2 million people have been marooned by the worst floods in the country's northeast in nearly two decades. At least 100 villages were inundated after flood water rushing from India breached a major embankment on a river. 10 people have been killed in Bangladesh and nearly 50 in India. Many parts of Bangladesh and neighboring regions in India are prone to flooding. Experts warn that climate change is increasing the likelihood of extreme weather conditions around the world. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
About yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners special.
E
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, May 22nd, 2022. I'm Atefa Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So, contact us and tell us what you think about IRIB English radio broadcasts. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program, Listeners Special. Please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, your program. And here I truly appreciate those of our great listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Rafan Ahmad, one of our regular listeners from India, Kristen Ivanach from Italy, and Don Glucka from the US. It shows your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio, Don Glucka, Rafan Ahmad, and Kristen Ivanach. And, of course, for your information, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very useful and important to us at IRIB English Radio, especially to our technicians and engineers. You know why? Because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service for our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an electronic QSL card from us. And of course, we've received many letters and emails from around the world, which I mention some of their names here. And later during the program, I will read these great emails. Konstantin Provotorov from Russia, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us an email. Peter Angie from Malaysia has sent us a letter, a handwritten letter. It's beautiful, the handwritten, the handwriting. Freddie Irigoyen, one of our regular listeners from Uruguay, has sent us an email. We've received a letter from Australia from Mr. Paul Simmons, one of our old and regular listeners. And the last but not the least is a letter. Yes, it's a handwritten letter from England from David Ansell. So after a short break, I will be back with these beautiful and great emails and letters from our great listeners around the world. Please stay with us. Welcome back. We have an email from Konstantin Provotorov from Russia. Konstantin Provotorov is one of our old and regular listeners from Russia. Konstantin says, "Dear IRIB English Radio staff, I have had a great pleasure in logging into your station, IRIB English Radio, and sending you my reception report, hoping that you will be in a position to verify it. Would you be kind enough to send me your QSL card or an EQSL card? I have also enclosed audio files recording your broadcast. Thank you in advance for your reply. Yours sincerely." Salam and warm greetings to you from IRIB English Radio from Tehran and Iran to Konstantin Provotorov from Russia. Thank you very much for sending us this email. It shows your commitment and support to IRIB English Radio, your radio. Of course, my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a verification. And you know, paper QSL, sending paper QSL card to our listeners is not possible at the time of pandemic. And thank you for the files you sent us. Yes, you enclosed audio files recording of IRIB English Radio broadcast, and we've received it. Thank you for that. Konstantin Provotorov from Russia, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio broadcast. Well, here we've received a handwritten letter from Peter NG from Malaysia. Peter says, dear sir or madam, salam and greeting from Malaysia. I would appreciate your kind attention as to have this report acknowledged and send to me a QSL card of IRIB Tehran. I thank you and await for your reply. Regard. Peter from Malaysia, salam and warm greetings to you. Thank you very much for sending us this letter, this beautiful handwritten letter from Malaysia. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card because, as I have said so many times, sending paper QSL card is not possible. So please accept our electronic QSL card. Peter from Malaysia. Peter, in your upcoming letters or emails, please tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. We are looking forward to hearing from you soon, Peter. And after a short break, I will be back with other emails from around the world. Welcome back. Here we have an email from Freddy Irigoyen from Uruguay, one of our regular listeners. So let's see what Freddy says. Hello, friends from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Broadcasting, or IRIB English Radio. I hope you are doing very well. I am pleased to be able to send you my report of reception of your radio. I live in Montevideo, Uruguay, and your signals are well received here. I attach to this report an audio recorded so that you can verify it. I am grateful for the transmission made, and I hope to tune in again soon. Salam and warm greetings to you, Freddy Irigoyen from Uruguay, and many thanks for sending us this email. We're so happy that the signals of IRIB English Radio are well received in your region. As you said, you live in Montevideo, Uruguay. That's great. Thank you for letting us know about this, the news. I mean, reflecting your views about the quality of the programs and signals of the IRIB English Radio, the shortwave. And that's great. Freddy, we're going from Uruguay. Write to us soon. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. And from Australia, we've received a letter. This is a really great letter from Mr. Paul Simmons from Australia. This is great because Mr. Paul Simmons has attached the photos of indigenous Australian land, South Australia, Ashbourne, if I'm right in pronouncing the name, and of course the indigenous animals. Here we've received very beautiful birds indigenous to Australia. So let's see what Mr. Paul Simmons from Australia tells us. Hello, I am writing to report reception of your radio station. And of course, with information. Overall reception of your station was excellent. Your signal strength was very strong, and there was no fading of the signal. There was no interference from stations on the frequency or from adjacent frequencies. And Mr. Paul Simmons says, I hope my reception report is of use to your station. If the details are correct, could you please verify with a QSL card? All the very best from South Australia. And with the picture of very beautiful birds in Australia, in South Australia, Ashburn. First of all, Mr. Paul Simmons, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, and from IRIB English Radio. We are very happy that the signals of IRIB English Radio are well received in Southern Australia. And we are so happy that the overall reception of IRIB English Radio was excellent in your region. And as you said, the signal strength was very strong and there was no fading for the signal. And you said there was no interference from stations on the frequency or adjacent frequency. And that's great. Thank you for letting us know your opinion and your views about the quality of the signals of IRIB English Radio in your region. And thank you very much for attaching the photos of the animals indigenous into your land. Paul Simmons from Australia, thank you very much for everything. We wish you all the best. Write to us soon. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. After a short break, we will be back with an email from England. Please stay with us. Welcome back. David Ansell from England has sent us a letter, a handwritten letter. David says, dear sirs or madams, it is my pleasure to report reception of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting to Europe on 9855. Reception of your station was good, no noise or interference, good signal, moderate fading, audio better than it used to be. If the details given above are in accordance with your schedule and show that I heard the broadcast, I would be very pleased to receive your QSL card or letter as confirmation of my reception. Thank you in anticipation and hoping to tune in again soon. Yours faithfully, Ansel, David Ansel from England. Salam and warm greetings to you, David Ansel from England. And please accept our appreciations to you for sending us this letter, this handwritten letter from England. It was great. The description of the signals of IRIB English Radio, as you said, IRIB English Radio signal was good. No noise or interference. Good signal, moderate fading audio, better than it used to be. And that's great. My colleagues, of course, will soon send you an electronic QSL card, an EQSL card as a confirmation. David Ansel, thank you very much. Please tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs in your upcoming letters or emails, David, and write to us soon. And dear listeners, time tells me that we have to wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special. But before wrapping up this program, again, I do send my gratitudes, warm gratitudes and appreciations to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports and letters and emails from around the world, including Don Glocka from the US, Rafwan Ahmad from India, Kristen Ivanovich from Italy, Konstantin Provotoro from Russia, Peter from Malaysia, Freddie Irigoyen from Uruguay, and Mr. Paul Simmons from Australia, and of course, David Ansell from England. Many thanks for being with us. Please keep in touch with the program, Listeners Special, your program, the Sunday program. Have a good time and goodbye.
The Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to englishradio@irib.ir. That is one word, englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the Ukraine conflict, there have been some major gains made by the Russian army, unlike what is being reported by the Western media. For example, the port city of Mariupol is now under full Russian control. This is while the Ukrainian Prime Minister Zelensky has said only diplomacy can end the war, unlike its partners like the U.S., who just got the green light for another $40 billion in military aid. Meanwhile, the world is suffering from food shortages and record inflation. Well, these are just some of the angles we'll be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Political analyst and blogger at The Polemicist, Jim Kavanaugh, joins us from New York. Also joining us is political analyst Rusia Segodnya from Rustam Safronov, who joins us from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Jim Kavanaugh, taking a look at the military advancements that has been made by Russia. Basically, the siege of the Azovstal is over, and it is reported that Russia is in full control of Mariupol. First of all, why is that deemed to be Russia's biggest victory yet, as it has been described?
Mariupol was the strongest redoubt of the Azov battalion, who were the most dedicated and vicious fighters on behalf of the Ukrainian, of the Kiev government. And there was an enormous number of fighters that were taken prisoner. I think it was almost 2,500 came out over the past few days and surrendered unconditionally to the Donbas and Russian troops. And that was a surrender, not an evacuation, as the American press presented it. So it demonstrates that, you know, it took a long time. It took longer than maybe that the Russians wanted or thought it would. But the Russians worked methodically for that victory, and it's a big victory, and it's going.
Okay, it seems like we may have lost our guest there. Rostam, let me ask you about how this gives Russia the advantage that it was looking for, and not only that, looking at the way that this at this point may then lead Russia to move into the Donbas region as a whole. I'm guessing that is the next military maneuver or strategy that Russia has. And if so, if it does take over Donbas, does that give an indication that perhaps the war is going to be over? I mean, is that Russia's military objective in this war?
Well, I think it's a minimum what Russia wants to get. That's liberation of Donbas from Ukrainian control, and giving, how Russia would present that, the people of Donbas a right to decide their destiny. Do they want to be independent or to be with Russia? But certainly not under Kiev control. Would Russia go further and continue advancing to another areas of Ukraine, trying to occupy, for example, entire coast of the Black Sea? That's remain to be seen. The question is the position of Kiev government. They do not want to give up. They do not recognize Russian rights to control the destiny of Donbas, and even don't want to give up in Crimea. All of that making truce in next future impossible. What is Mariupol meant? That's a big chunk of military force what Ukraine has finally was substantially tarnished, diminished, because that so-called die-hard, almost like Ukrainian SS fighters, which used to not supposed to surrender and whatever, they used to be glorified, very dedicated, very much brainwashed with a semi-nationalistic, almost Nazi propaganda. Finally, they have to give up. And it's giving Russia some moral advantage. Okay. I mean, military too, because defense of Azovstal plant was a huge military event and siege of that. And it was distract a lot of Russian forces from advancing to entire area of Donbas. They used to be paralyzed there because, you know, tied up, tangled up. So now it's over, and it will help to liberate some forces for further advances. So that's how I'm seeing the situation.
So that's one way of looking at it, Jim Kavanaugh. But the other way that mainly Western media is depicting this, and we're trying to just get to the bottom of what's going on militarily, is that this war has been or special military operation has been a failure when it comes to Russia. We know, and I'm sure you're familiar with how it's been described as what was supposed to be a lightning conquest, as it's been written, but yet it's been somewhat drawn out, and Russia has been unable to take the capital, Kyiv, seen as a failure and a pullback of forces. But based on what we're seeing today, I mean, that's not a military failure on the part of Russia. Are the online, whether online or any other description of Russia failing military, just meant to hamper and disappoint the Russian morale, so to speak?
Well, it's meant to gin up support in the West and in the United States for a fight that they believe they can win. We have, I think it's the case, and I don't think, you know, I don't want to pretend not to recognize that the things didn't go as quickly as Russia probably thought they would, and that many people who were supporters of the Russian cause here thought it would. But I think that, you know, when you look at the real deep military situation, The Russians are achieving their objectives. And the primary objective wasn't to the defeat of an enemy doesn't happen because you take cities. It happens because you destroy their military. And this is what the Russians have been methodically doing, destroying the Ukrainian military apparatus from its logistics and its ability to resupply and its communications possibilities, et cetera. And the Russians really want to secure the Donbas republics. They want to secure the coast, and they have been largely successful on that. So the thing that's been happening in the United States is the West is, tactical retreats, changes of position, movements of have been portrayed as Russia's losing. And that has encouraged a lot of people to say, we have to fight, and American politicians, we can fight this to win it, and not only to help Ukraine, but to weaken Russia. I think that's a fantasy and a very dangerous one that is getting us into a very close to a third world war.
All right, now comes one of the key questions that I'm hoping that you can answer, Rustam, and that is how it has been reported that the Azov fighters, of which it has been described to be far right, and perhaps you can expand on that more for us, is said to have had an impact or an effect in this conflict. Please tell us about the Azov fighters, who they are, what does their capture mean, how many numbers there are, and whether one of the main reasons that Putin went into the special military operation was, as he said, to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. This has been talked about, but now that they have been captured, many of them, tell us what it means in terms of the war.
Well, it used to be a few thousands of fighters of Azov, very elite and very well trained and equipped, not even a detachment, it's almost brigade, so because it was increasing and recruiting new members, and it was very prestigious to serve in that detachment. That were highly motivated military men, volunteers, soldiers, convinced nationalists. A lot of them right now, when they used to be searched during the surrender, have in their body tattoo of the Hitler swastika, pictures of Stepan Bandera. One of those individuals, I think with the name of David Kasatkin or something like that, he had a sign additionally to everything else, to different kind of slogans and words and swastika. He had also signed, kill all of them. So it's like a soldier who was looking at him, saying, like, who do you really want to kill? Like, who all, like, whatever, entire people in the face of the earth. So that was very motivated people. And generally speaking, in Ukrainian military forces after 2014, when Russia took over Crimea, new Ukrainian authorities put a lot of emphasis into the nationalistic spirit of Ukrainian army. First of all, they moved from the east all military schools to Lvov, to that area, to Ternopil, Ivano-Frantsov, to the west. And they inserted special political commissars from the western part of Ukraine, which was traditionally much more nationalistic, into military structure to be able to discipline and boost morale in nationalistic way. So Azov was a core of all of that. That's why Azov was defending biggest city in the area of Donbas, which rebellion republics wasn't able to conquer. So. Mm-hmm. That's why the failure of Azov meant so much. I told you before, it's almost like SS used to be in Nazi Germany.
Right, Azov. Well, that's how it's been described. And Jim Kavanaugh, Ukraine is the world's only nation to actually have this neo-Nazi formation within its military ranks. And again, as our guest there talked about them, they are very capable to earn that. And that is perhaps why the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said that they are the ones that are being targeted. But again, the picture that's being painted is not as such when you listen to Western media. that Putin's just out of his mind to even mention this, and that that's just some kind of, I don't know, illusion or delusion that the Russian president has. What are your thoughts on the fact that now the arrest of and the death of some of these Azov fighters is a factor in this war?
Well, it is a factor. It's always been a factor. And but your point is valid. I don't know to the extent to which the West and Western media is willing to recognize this. I mean, the Azov battalion is one of a number of really fascistic battalions. And these are groups, that political groups, that whose legacy goes back to fighting with Hitler in the Second World War. And they're not ashamed of it. They're proud of it. And they boast about it. And they call themselves Nazis. So, and you do have a relationship between, you know, the fascist groups around the world, especially in Europe, look to them, because as you say, this is the only nation in the world where these groups are highly integrated into the state apparatus and the military apparatus, and they've changed the ideological framework and climate of the country since 2014. So, you know, you have groups around the world that look to them for inspiration. The Buffalo shooter in New York, last week in New York, took his inspiration from the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter, who took his inspiration from the Azov battalion, whom he visited in Ukraine. And you have the fact that if these groups win, that's going to be an impetus, and it's going to be an inspiration to fascist groups around the world. And if they lose, that's going to be a defeat for them. So this is part of what's going on here, and it's an important part.
Yeah, and that's not a narrative that you're going to hear. What you just said is not something you're going to hear specifically in Western media. Okay, let's take a look at another development here, Rustam, and that is the fact that you're looking at Finland and Sweden and the membership to NATO. Now, the question I have is not just these two countries, but the way that they are going about becoming a member, the incentive behind it. Do you think that there is some kind of scaremongering tactics that perhaps the U.S. is using for countries, European countries, like these two, that say, listen, if you don't join NATO, you could be next, something to that effect, in order not only to get weapon sales, but also obviously to have membership dues, because obviously we know they have to pay that to the NATO organization.
Well, you're right about that, absolutely. In one point, when president was Mr. Donald Trump, he used to argue all the time, Europe and this rich nation of Europe do not contribute enough in all this defense apparatus, security issues in Europe. They do not pay enough. Why only Americans have to carry that weight, this weight? And all these leads would be useful for United States. But I wouldn't deny a natural fear of that nation's in general atmosphere. Because we have to admit, majority of so-called civilized world, Western world, they portray that action of Russia as an aggression. And conversations like narrative, oh, you're the next, it's very much spread around the people who want to be scared. I mean, like, for example, some nationalists in Central Asia saying, oh, Kazakhstan going to be the next, you know, let's like whatever, move further away from Russia. Like in European nations saying, oh, next thing like Putin will take over Baltic republics. Of course, all of that seems to me as a very big exaggeration, and Russia doesn't have energy or drive for that. With Ukraine, it was a different story. It was a combination of two factors. Yes, Russia, Kremlin are considering armament of Ukraine and attempt to join the NATO as an existential threat. But it was especially painful and dangerous because, yes, Mr. Putin and a lot of people in Russia thinking, we grow up from the one root, these three nations, Russian, Belarusians, and Ukrainians. They're almost the same. They're almost one people, not exactly, but almost. So, and for them especially, they drive to the West. That's especially upsetting, treacherous thing, which has to be prevented by any cost. That's what contribute into that special military operation. Mm-hmm. is the rationale. Well, Finland and Sweden. Putin said, like, we don't really care about so much. I mean, it's bad, but we don't have anything against these nations, and we're not like, yes, we do. We will create necessary step, move troops, whatever, create different bases in the border, but it's not where we're seeing dangers from. You could see, like, Ukraine with Azov, with a very powerful nationalistic rhetoric, with a suppressing Russian-speaking population in Donbass seems being much more dangerous to Kremlin. That's okay. Why it's a different story.
All right, so here we have Zelensky. Aside from the fact that it watches as countries join NATO within a span of a very short period of time, and aside from the fact that the EU is not prepared to have membership for it, it says, Zelensky is saying, a diplomatic solution is still possible. Diplomacy is the only way to end the war. Well, that's fine and dandy, but then you have the U.S. got another $40 billion just approved, and you still have the push for a military solution to come not only from the U.S., but obviously it leading the pack of NATO countries, NATO member countries. What is the story there? Do you think Zelensky, Jim Kavanaugh, wants some kind of negotiations now? Or is he just saying that, and he has to follow whoever is ordering him?
I think that Zelensky is not in control of the situation, and I think that you'd have to be silly to not think that he's every day on the phone and zooming call with his handlers in Washington and the CIA and the American embassy, and he's under pressure from the right-wing fascists in Ukraine who do not want to settle this with Russia. Look. There was a diplomatic situation. This is the whole point. There was a diplomatic situation that was arrived at 8 years ago. And he was elected as president a couple of years ago to implement it, and he couldn't do it. And the United States doesn't want the war to stop, and the right-wing fascists don't want a war to stop. And his own senior advisor is on the record. You can see it on the internet saying a war with Russia is the only way we're going to get into NATO. So there is it's very difficult because the diplomatic solution, which is neutrality for Ukraine, no NATO, recognize Crimea as Russian and the Donbass republics as independent, is what Russia is after, and they're not going to stop. If they don't get that, they've lost. And if Ukraine gives that up, they have lost. This is quite clear. One side or the other of this is going to suffer a decisive defeat, and it cannot be hidden. And that's why, you know, this idea of a diplomatic solution is fine. There was one that could have worked, which would have kept the Donbass republics as autonomous regions within a unified Ukrainian state. That was destroyed by Ukraine.
All right, Rustam, looking at the goal that the U.S. has, as it has stated, even though we know that the real goal, which it has also stated, being that it wants Russia to be militarily defeated, but it also wants Russia to have total devastation economically. Now, it's pushing really hard for that. In some ways, it has been successful. But when you take a look at how the Russian ruble, for example, is now the world's top performing currency for the year 2022, up 11% against the dollar, and you're still looking at EU countries buying the oil, and there are even talks of other commodities being added to the payment in ruble scheme, such as wheat maybe and meat. Do you think that U.S. then is defeated in its intentions when it comes to the sanctions regime against Russia?
You know, United States is a very powerful country, capacities still. I wouldn't say it's United States is defeated. They could just became little more practical and stop these attempts totally destroy Russia by trying to drown more and more Russian Ukraine into that war. That would be maybe more practical solution. But so far, the idea of like Reagan did, to make Russia as bleed as possible during the war, and finally to destroy Russia economically and maybe politically as well, because obviously if Russia would lose, that would be not only the end of the Mr. Putin, that would be the end of contemporary political structure in Russia, and it could encourage different process of disintegration of Russia and so on. So